to Black White Mass Incarceration Show. I am your host, Sierra Cobb. Black White Mass Incarceration Show is a space that is used to uplift the unheard voices of the criminal and social justice issues that many face today. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoy. All right, today we have Rhonda, who is currently incarcerated in Georgia Correctional, and she's here to share her experience and her story and hopefully get some advocacy towards her situation. So if Rhonda, you want to introduce yourself and then kind of just tell us what's going on.
Murder charge. I was under the 7-year. We have, like, in Georgia, we have different kind of sentences. It's like a 7-year life sentence, the 14-year, and then now they have the 30-year life sentence. But I was locked up under the 7-year life sentence. But I've done 30 years. This year will be 30 years that I've done on the 7-year life sentence.
So you want to kind of tell us the reason, well, what landed you inside of the Georgia State Prison?
Yes. I was in college at Emory University, and I kind of got in a relationship with someone. It was kind of a really toxic relationship. This is so hard to talk about.
It's all right.
We had a very abusive relationship, I would say. It was kind of angry, volatile relationship, and
take your time, but I
haven't said anything about it for a long time because I feel really, really, you know, guilty because I did take somebody's life, and it's just really bothered me all these years, so it's hard to talk about something.
Well, I want you to know I'm a domestic violence survivor over 30-something years who has almost lost her life 3 times in a row from 3 different guys. So I understand. And sometimes you have to do what you have to do. It's either you versus them, especially when...
Go ahead. And then sometimes, you play it over and you're thinking, well, I could have got away in a million different ways. I left, I came back. Like I moved out before all this happened. I had moved out one time and moved closer with a friend. And then, he kept visiting me and I went back again and I kind of knew it was a bad relationship, And mm-hmm. I went back anyway. And then when I got back, it seemed like it got even worse. And I loved him so much. It's just a horrible thing. No matter how bad it was, I just really loved him. I didn't want to leave him, but it didn't help. We had different issues, and quit crying. But I just didn't want to say anything for a long time, even when I got locked up, because I was like, I feel like there was I could have got away. I left. It was a situation I felt got out of, but then I was like, I was there, and it's just like, sometimes I would just think, man, I've been through so much with you,
Mm-hmm. Well, Rhonda, you can't put a lot of blame on yourself. It's not easy to leave an abusive relationship. I've, like I said, I'm a domestic violence victim, and it was never easy for me to leave, and I had children by the first one. And leaving is never easy, but we also shouldn't be punished for saving our lives. Your story kind of reminds me of Centoya Brown and a few others who were punished for taking the life of their abuser. And, I don't think that's fair because it's different for women. It's not easy for women to leave because we're emotional creatures. So, you know, we don't just basically cut off emotions and leave and be like, oh, well, I'm not going back to that, even though we know that it's not healthy. It's just something we can't do. It's just not, that's why so many women are abused and why so many women can't leave, or it's hard for them to leave, because we're very emotional. We're like, we're not like men who can, you know, cut off emotions.
I think since I've been locked up, though, I kind of, it's one of the things I've worked on, and I know sometimes it's like to a bad extent, I try to cut myself off emotionally, because, you know, replaying this, being locked up 30, replaying it, you think of a million different things you could have done different, a whole bunch of thousand different things you could have did different. You know, especially being locked up 30 years, and you go and do different kind of groups, different kind of people you're talking to, you know, domestic violence classes. I took battered women. I took different things, and I was thinking there's just so many things I could have did different. But then, like you said, I was really emotional. For one, I was really young. I've realized that since I've got older, I make smarter decisions. But when you're 20 years old, you don't make very smart decisions, especially when you're emotional. It's just... It's something, you know, that I've worked on, but it's nothing I can change. It's nothing I can change now.
Right.
And so it's a really hard situation, because it's something I want to change. It's nothing I can't change, and I'm trying to heal from that. And then it's also like you don't really want to talk about it anymore. You kind of want to just go away, but it's not going away.
Well, the only way to heal is to talk about it and to actually go through the emotions, because bearing the emotions is still going to be there at the end of the day, and anything can trigger it. So you have to go through the motions to heal it, and you have to forgive yourself and you have to forgive him in order to start that healing process. That's the only way to start healing.
I agree with you. And I think that's just the hard situation of where I'm at. It's kind of really hard to forgive myself. I'm just having a hard time. I just kind of rather ignore it sometimes, you know, or let it be in the past. And it took me a little while, but I am beginning to forgive myself. And then it's kind of hard, even like after you forgive yourself, I don't know how, you know, different kind of states do different kind. I know you're not from Georgia. I think you're from
North Carolina. It ain't too much different.
but the thing is, like, say if I had a parole interview, you have to, like, even when they're talking to you, you have to, you know, do your crime. You know, some people say they're not guilty or they're guilty. You know, I have took full responsibility. You know, I've said I'm guilty. I've not said anybody else done anything. But you have to, you know, relive the whole thing. And they kind of like here tell you you got to put your past behind you and move on and heal, which I've really tried to do. I've done really so many groups. I've done everything I can imagine, not just for myself, but also to, like, help. There's people coming in prison, and man, their life is just, the stories I hear is just heartbreaking. But so I try to be like mentors to other people and stuff like that. But it's hard when you're trying to heal yourself, and then you have to bring it up and talk about it again and over. I tell my story, and it helps. But then, you know, I always feel like, you know, people look at you and you're judged by what happened 30 years ago. Even then, you know what I'm saying? So it's hard. It's easier to talk to people that's been through it, and then they'll understand, well, shoot, I done something really dumb, and yes, I did this, and whatever. But it's harder when you're talking to somebody that's never been there.
Right. And I think that's with anything. You know, when you're not directly impacted, it's hard for you to understand the actions or the emotions of somebody else when you've never been in that situation.
I think I find it easier to talk to people that maybe they're coming in as a mentor, because most of them, if they hadn't been in an abusive relationship with a partner, they've been in an abusive relationship with a family member or some kind of way, something has happened, it's easier to relate. I guess it's easier for me to talk to them and than trying to tell my story to somebody, you know, maybe I feel like I've never been through a situation and put somewhere that, you know, you made the decision in a split second that they'll be like, well, you could have did this. You know what I'm saying? And it just feels like, and sometimes when I'm looking at myself from a 50-year-old, from a 20-year-old, you know, even me, I'm like, dang, you could have did this different. But, you know, hindsight.
Yeah, hindsight, you know. So, but like I said, you got to God forgives us for everything that, you know, we do as long as we come to Him and admit
that with all my heart. And it took me a long time to think God should forgive me.
And He will. I mean, but you got to forgive yourself, because if you don't forgive yourself, how can He forgive you if you won't forgive yourself? And He, I mean, you know, He was there. He saw everything that happened. And, you know, I think He understands, you know, why you did what you did. But you, the only way to, you know, help others and help yourself is to heal that. And I know it's, you know, it's a long road to heal something like that, especially when you take somebody's life that you love. And sometimes you have no choice but to do those things. But, you know, you got to heal from that and take your testimony to help all these other women, because I mean, the domestic violence rate out here is crazy high. You know what I mean? A lot of women don't stand up for themselves, and so their life is taken. Like, every day, it triggers me. Every day I'm on YouTube and I see, you know, a lot of women who, you know, their lives are gone because their spouse just couldn't let them go for whatever reason, or jealous, or, you know, whatever the reason is, and take their lives in front of the children and taking the children's lives. And so, in order for us to get a handle on it, you know, it's we have to heal from it. And I'm still healing from mine. And I'm glad that you're on here, because I actually did another episode with a guy who took his girlfriend's life. And so, you know, my thing is bringing awareness to domestic violence and how we can change it. But the way to change it is through healing trauma, because a lot of us have underlying trauma that comes into our relationships, and we tend to take it out on our spouses a lot. And so, you know, the partner that you were with probably had generational trauma, and he just took it out on you. You know what I mean?
Me and him, that's one of the things we bonded over. Like, some things that happened to me when I was, like, in high school, like, with fighting and stuff, he knew about it. Something happened with him. Like, he got into it with somebody and ended up shooting himself. It's like we kind of bonded over. That's kind of what got us together. It was just a very toxic bond, but that's what we started talking about. And then when I was younger, my dad shot my mother. He ended up shooting somebody else and my mom, but my mom was trying to leave him because he was very abusive to her. So, you know, I don't know how long he did in jail. He went to prison, I know that, but he shot my mother, but she lived. But he was a very abusive thing. So I think it's just something I grew up with. It's just hard to watch that. And I think I began to think that was acceptable, not just even my behavior and other people's behavior toward me.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. When I look back at that, it's funny, I was just talking to somebody the other day, and I was telling them, you know, the thing that happened with my mom and my dad, and they're like, oh my gosh, you never know what somebody's went through, you know?
And that goes to show you.
They looked at me and they said, I would have never thought that. She said, I would have looked at you and thought, oh, you had such a great childhood.
You see what I'm saying? And that just goes to show that you really didn't know what true love looked like, because your father didn't show it to your mother. And so, that's the thing. Like, a lot of us don't know what real love looks like, because, you know, we emulate what we see when we're growing up. And if we don't see our parents affectionate and loving one another, then, you know, we're not going to expect that from our spouse. And so it just continues the cycle on and on and on, because, you know, you have to have a good model of what love is for you to know what it is and what to look for when you get older in your spouse. And a lot of us don't have that. We just kind of go off of what we think it is, or what we hope it to be. And, you know, a lot of times it's not that. And then a lot of times we don't, you know, we disregard the red flags that we see, because we'd be like, oh, well, I love them. And, oh, well, you know, hopefully they'll change and I can help them change. And, you know, the only person that can help them change is them.
I can help them change, mm-hmm. and they can help me. That's my favorite line ever. Used to be. That was my favorite line. Mm-hmm. You hit the nail on the head.
So, yeah. I get it. I understand. So tell us a little bit more about your sentence and, you know, what's going on with Georgia and how you're trying to get attention.
Well, Georgia is different. I've just kind of been looking this up lately because I'm having a hard time. I'll have a life sentence plus 5 years for possession of a firearm, which is, like I told you, I was on the 7-year sentence. Most lifers here, I would say they do between maybe 22 and 27 if you're under the old law, you know, the 7 or the 14. Mm-hmm. But I've done 30. My issue is the victim's family. They're, you know, they advocate for me to stay in prison. So it kind of depends on that. Most lifers, if they do longer than the 27, I would say 20. I'll even go up to 28, but most of the time 27. If they're under the old law, they usually just do that much time if they don't have somebody advocating for them to stay in. Mm-hmm. And it really don't matter about your sentence because some people here have like two life sentences. You know, maybe they've convicted of two murder charges. They'll still go home as long as they don't have the victim. That's usually the only thing that holds people in jail in Georgia.
Is the families advocating for you to stay in?
Yes, they very much are. They even got a mayor to write a letter in the newspaper. If you pull me up, I'm sure you'll see the article. It comes up easily. And on the end, it's like, they gave me, in Georgia, you get this thing called 90-day letters. It's like a clemency letter. Mm-hmm. And within those 90 days, you can present information, you know, your family can present information, you know, about you, which we did present a lot of information about me. And that we had letters from law enforcement agencies from where I'm from, the sheriff and like chief deputies and stuff like that. They wrote letters for me. Prior warden wrote a letter for me, and the lady over female services, she's retired. She wrote letters for me. A lot of people that work here with me that's retired now, they wrote letters for me. And of course, different people in the community and different people that would employ me once I leave. So they all wrote, you know, got a lot of letters for me, but then they also, the victims, I think it's the judge and the DA, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's the three people they notify.
Mm-hmm.
And they can also get letters against you, advocate for you to stay in. And on that article I was speaking about, if they got like the mayor of the town where they live at to write like a newspaper article about me or whatever. And on the thing it says, at the end of the article, if you read it, you would think I'm going to move back to their town. Because he's like, we wouldn't want her to get out and, like, move back to our area. Our area is a really nice area. We're building it up. Be safe for our children and stuff like this. You know, he kind of wrote the letter, like, and if you disapprove of her, coming out, write so-and-so at the victim services or whatever. But in the article, if you'll read it, it's kind of, like, worded, like, I'm going to their community, you know, and please write a letter so she won't come here. But I'm not going anywhere near their community. I didn't even live there. I just lived near there because I was going to school. But I would go back down south where I'm from. But, you know, the way they stated it, they were like, you know, getting the community together. So,
I mean, to me, that still doesn't make sense. I mean, you've done 30 years. So that's my problem with the system is how they want to cancel people. Like, they don't make mistakes and, like, they don't do illegal things. A lot of them just don't get caught for it. But...
You have 1 minute left.
In Georgia, it's different. Like I said, like some people, you know, they have like two life sentences for two different murders and maybe like some torture and stuff involved. And I've did more time than they have done.
Do y'all have, are you calling back?
Yeah, I can call you back.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I'll call you right back.
All righty.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to tell you. It don't really matter if you have two life sentences and you have two murder charges or anything else. People, like on my last packet, what we did was kind of present to the parole board, like, hey, you know, this was our crime, and this is what was involved in it, and this is kind of, other crimes that have more time, more, you know, murder charges, more anything, and it really didn't make a difference.
Do y'all have restorative justice down there?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
I'm going to check into it. I think I know a few people down there because I think that's really important to start restorative justice, especially in situations like that, because...
What is restorative justice?
So restorative justice is where they have sessions with the victim and then the person accused of committing the crime, and they let them talk. And so... I know our prison just started doing that where they have them in the prison, they'll have them in the room and they'll just talk about what happened. And in so many words, you're healing one another. You're able to talk through it. That person's family member is able to see you as a human and see, you know, how well you have come along and kind of understand, you know, why you did it and what led up to you doing what you did to their loved one. And it not only helps you heal, but it helps them heal. And then instead of them, you know, saying, oh, we want them put away for the rest of their life, then they can kind of help advocate to say that, you know, well, I've seen the change and, you know, I think it's okay for them to be released. A lot of states are starting to do that.
Restorative justice is, we had that. It's called victim, something, called something else, though. But the only thing is, the only way in Georgia is the victim has to initiate the contact. Anything else is illegal.
See, that's not really restorative justice.
Yeah.
You know,
that's the only way you can do it here. And when you, I've been locked up 30 years and I've only seen it happen one time. And I actually worked with the girl that they did it with. And they do a lot of therapy with the person that's going to talk to the victim and the, you know, the victim's family.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, they ask you questions, but you can't, you only can answer their direct question. Cause she was telling me what the people were telling her, like, don't speak any words. It's a question they ask you. Answer the straight question. Don't add on or whatever. She was just telling me it was kind of restrictive.
Right. See, that's not really true restorative justice because both sides are able to talk.
She's the only one I know, so.
That's wild. So you're basically want people to advocate as much as they can to help you get released, right? Okay. I will definitely see what I can do. I think I have a few connects down there. What part of Georgia are you in?
We're in Alto, Georgia. It's kind of North Georgia, kind of like below Gainesville, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm not really from up here, so it's a little different because I'm usually actually from down south mostly.
That sucks, you know, to be somewhere that, be locked up somewhere that you're not even from. Have you been able to see your family?
I do, but they have to plan visits like to come here because it's like 6 hours, and then my little nephews are really little. You know, my sisters and my nieces and nephews have kids now, and they're little. It's hard to drive a child that far, so usually they have to get like a motel room and stay overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then our visitation is only 2 hours, so they drive for 2 hours, and then, you know, they leave. So.
Then they leave, yeah. That's hard. I'm sorry. Yeah. So is there anything that you would like the audience to know or, you know, any advice you would give women that are currently in domestic violence situations that could, you know, bring their awareness, help them bring their awareness up?
Yes, I think the biggest thing is that you can't be embarrassed, that you got to talk to somebody, even if it feels like you shouldn't talk to anybody. I think you should talk to somebody about what's going on with you and, you know, not just to save yourself, but, you know, not put you in a situation that's going to, you know, impact the rest of your life. You know, sometimes you just have to, I know it sounds bad, but sometimes I think a lot of things, especially with me, it was embarrassment, you know what I'm saying? And, mm-hmm. and like, I didn't really want to talk to people about it because to me, I feel like at that time I thought I was a strong, indestructible young woman. But, you know, as I look back, I was very vulnerable and non-indestructible and made very poor decisions. But I think you just have to, you know, not be embarrassed and talk to somebody. You know what I'm saying? Anybody. I mean, even if you just have to talk to God. Because, you know, sometimes you get so alienated, you feel like not even God's listening to you.
Mm-hmm. And he's really the only one that could direct you, you know, how to really get out
exactly.
in a safe way. Yeah.
Exactly. I don't remember a moment of prayer back then. Like, I was just like, it just, you even feel alienated from God. Like, you don't even talk to anybody anymore.
Yeah, I get it. I understand. Well, Rhonda, I will definitely, you know, put this out here. And I think Reverend Ronnie had sent me your links. I will put the links down below for people to go sign your petition. And see okay. if we can reach out to some more activist groups, maybe even, you know, national, to kind of advocate. But I know when I was listening to Centoya Brown's story, she said even though she had, you know, Kim Kardashian and all them advocating, it still took a while. Like, basically God was the one that released her because I think the family was doing the same thing or, you know, saying they wanted her in there. And so, you know, she got denied parole, I think, twice. And then finally, they, you know, granted her parole, but we will definitely keep your name out there and, you know, just pray to the Lord that, you know, he softened the hearts of the families to forgive you. I mean, it's been 30 years later.
I was just talking to somebody the other day, and they said maybe we're praying the wrong prayers. This is, you said the exact words they said. So maybe we shouldn't be asking for your release. Maybe we should be asking to soften the hearts of your victim's family. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's just really strange that you said that. Just spoke that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to, you know, really convict them. Because you have to forgive, because it's in the Bible. God says if you don't forgive, he's not going to forgive you, because he forgives us for everything. So to really lay that on their hearts and soften their hearts, you know, to forgive you, you know, and just look at who you are today and not who you were back then, but even maybe look at who you were back then to understand, you know, what situation you were put in. And there's faults on both sides. I mean, I'm a domestic violence victim, so I can sit here and say there's fault on both sides. It's not one person's fault. You know what I mean? It's on both sides. Exactly. You're both traumatized, and it's on both sides. It's not just one person. And one person shouldn't carry or hold that blame. It's on both sides. Anybody could leave at any time. You know what I mean? And it's not really, you can even leave at any time, but leave it in a manner where everybody is safe, and that's not easy to do. You know what I mean? It's not easy to do. And so I will definitely be praying for you, and definitely just keep your name out there and keep the pressure. And, you know, just praying that, like I said, again, that the Lord will soften the hearts of the victims' families, you know, that, you know, you've done your time. You know, you've done the time for what you've done, and you can't keep holding somebody in prison forever. Like, that's going to fix it. So, you know, praying for their healing, because the only way for them to see who you are as a person is that they start healing. So praying that the Lord also starts to heal their hearts and minds, so that, you know, they are understanding and say, okay, well, she's, you know, done the time, and it's, you know, we forgive her, let her go.
Yeah. So, well, thank you so much, Sierra, for talking to me. It was wonderful.
You're welcome. I'm here if you need me. You know, if you want to get my number and call straight through if you need to talk or vent, I'm here. Just call me.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right, Rhonda. I'll be praying for you. Have a good day.
You too.
I will. Bye-bye.